the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, supported by great listeners, including Patricia Player, Kathleen Lowy, Jeffrey Adair, and Michael Gill. If you're able and you'd like to, you can support this program. Go to my website, peterbcollins.com. The links for our voluntary subscriptions are on the right-hand side of the homepage, starting at just $5 a month. And in our second segment today, journalist and activist Mike Elk talks about the strike against the Huffington Post. You always wanted a lover. I only wanted a Yes, way back in the 80s, the Pet Shop Boys were singing about the importance of jobs. And jobs are the top priority in our political discourse and the problems our country faces today. Thomas Frank leads our show today. He is the Easy Chair columnist, writes the lead essay in Harper's Magazine every month. And don't be too depressed, but he took a month off in the, the September issue. He's replaced by George McGovern. How was that engineered, Tom?
I don't know. That was the editors did that.
I see.
I didn't have a hand in that. I'm sorry to say.
So you actually get a vacation from your once a month gig?
They were nice and let me take a vacation this once a month. Yes. Or I'm sorry. This one time.
This
yes.
One month. And of course, the real reason is you've been slaving away on a new book. Are we allowed to talk about that?
Yes, I do have a new book. It will be out hopefully at Christmas time, but more likely in January.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And your topic, have you picked a title or has your publisher put
yes,
the
it's
pink?
Yes, it's about – I never told you this before, Peter B. Collins. I'm a bird watcher, and it's a book about my adventures in bird watching.
Well, you need to be careful about that. I have a friend named Peter Laufer. And Peter wrote a book that was about those who refused to serve in the military in Iraq and Afghanistan. And while he was on that book tour, somebody at a bookstore asked him, "What are you going to write about next?" And he said, "Oh, something lighter, maybe like butterflies." Well, that produced a series of emails, and he's written two books now about butterflies and about the illicit trade in endangered species. So be careful, because you might be writing about birds, Mr. Audubon.
It's totally possible. But no, the book, it's another book about politics. I've been meaning Peter B. Collins, when you live in this, I live in Washington, D.C., you know, and when you live in this town, you get bloody sick of politics. And I am really sick of it. And, the Democrats are the Republicans are interesting, you know, because they're forever bouncing back with something new and crazy. But the Democrats are just seem totally hopeless. You know, they answer to this one constituency, you know, sort of enlightened banker constituency, and they give not a damn about what everybody else thinks. You know, I was writing for the Wall Street Journal and nobody gave a damn. You know, so I want to retreat into the world of literature, which is where I belong anyways, and get away from politics. But the spectacle is just too it's just too much. I had to write about it one more time, and so mm-hmm. Yes, I wrote another book about the right wing comeback in the last 2 years, which is really an amazing story. If you think about it in an abstract historical way, it's a you know, it's like a story of human dynamism. And it's like, you know, something that you'd read about in Greek mythology, how they managed to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Tales of brave Ulysses.
Well, Tom, let's riff a little off of this, because item at the end of July, the Progressive Caucus of the California Democratic Party passed a resolution with a 10-point indictment of Barack Obama's failures in leadership and a call for coordination of primary challenges, either using favorite sons or finding a qualified person who would actually challenge Obama from his left. And then Drew Weston published a piece, an op-ed, in the Sunday New York Times, which I think kind of blew the scab off many people's bruises and cuts to date from the Obama...
Yeah. No, that was that story was really good. And I'll just give you a hint. My book is... my book is along similar lines, very similar. In fact, what made me really happy about that Drew Weston article was to realize that I wasn't the only one, the only one thinking along these lines. I go a lot farther than that. You know, it's a book, obviously.
Yeah.
But
well,
it's
I can't
very
wait
similar, very
because
similar.
It was over a year ago in a conversation with Tom Hayden that I first floated the idea, for me, I'm not saying I was the first in the United States, but about a primary challenge to Obama, not to try to defeat him, but to try to send a message from the left that he cannot take his base for granted. And I believe he's played out that string beyond the point of elasticity, and we're seeing a lot of disaffection being expressed, even among pretty careful, centrist, loyal Democrats who are saying, where's the leadership? How could this guy, you know, voluntarily put Social Security and Medicare on the table when they weren't related to the deficit talks?
Yeah, that's right. And it's very disheartening. And I was once a big fan of his. I lived in Chicago for many years, and he was my state senator. And you would meet the guy at, you know, civic functions in the neighborhood. And he was so, you know, very highly intelligent man, and, you know, silver-tongued, just the most amazing public speaker you ever heard. And I mean, even when he's speaking extemporaneously with no – he just has to stand up and start talking about something. He does a very, very good job. And so these were skills that I always really admired. I thought he was a great man. I thought he – in 2008, I thought he was the man for the moment.
Yeah.
So did a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a huge disappointment to watch him – fumble the ball, you know, so just repeatedly. At this point, though, I mean, just the last, I mean, look, like everybody else, I'm of two minds about this. On the one hand, yes, I would love it if we had amongst Democrats had a debate over who we were. But on the other hand, oh my God, Michelle Bachmann,
yeah.
Rick Perry, you know.
But that is the wedge that Obama, Rahm Emanuel, and the hard-nosed politicos have been planning for some time. They know that we are stuck. They know that whether it's about the Supreme Court or, you know, the enforcement of religiosity in public spheres, that we will reject the Republican. But
yeah.
it doesn't deal with low turnout.
Is Mitt Romney that much worse than Obama? I mean, they're very similar kinds of people with very similar ideas about things. Here's an idea that I've been thinking about is some kind of, I mean, look, all of this stuff is pipe dreams anyway. You and I can't mount, you know, challenges. The politics is an extraordinarily expensive business
mm-hmm.
nowadays. But what would be really interesting would be to see a liberal challenge in the Republican Party. I mean, there used to be, I was just reading last night about what was his name? Edward Brooke, who was a Republican senator from Massachusetts, super
right.
duper liberal.
Yeah.
This is back in the 70s. Of course.
First African American in the Senate, right?
Yeah, since after Reconstruction, yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but there were other liberal Republicans at the time, lots of them. I mean, not lots, but you know,
sure. The Nelson Rockefeller, Chuck Percy, the guy Packwood from Oregon.
That's right. Well, we had Nancy Kassebaum from Kansas, and mm-hmm. you know what's really funny is you think now about Bob Dole. Remember, he was their candidate in 1996. He's more liberal than Obama.
Well, I take your point, and that is you know, a sharp criticism of Obama, certainly not any kind of endorsement of Mitt Romney. But do you see that there are kind of several groups of people? One are the disaffected Democrats who may not show up to the polls next November. Then there are those who will hold their noses, and then there are those who say, he's my man, and you can't peel me away from him no matter what. But is there a way to get Obama to recognize that he needs to address his base and he needs to stand and fight? I mean, the New York Times had a story this Sunday that there's a debate in the White House about whether they should take on the Republicans over the economy. I mean, number one, that debate's a little late.
Isn't that funny?
And number two, they got to debate it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. They got to think about whether or not they want to. Oh, my God. The problem is, Mr. Collins, that people like you and me are going against a sort of institutionalized logic of Washington, D.C. And the incentives and the forces that people like, you know, at Obama's level and, you know, Bill Daley and whoever else is calling the shots in the White House these days, the incentives that they look to have nothing to do with people like you and me and what our opinions happen to be. Nothing whatsoever. It's, you know, the closest that sort of opinion making gets to influencing their decisions, I would say, is like the Washington Post's editorial board. And you know about these guys. They're very famously liberal on social issues and conservative on economic issues. And so if Obama
and hardliners on war issues.
Yeah, and they're extremely anti-union. I mean, it's one of their peculiar things. But if Obama puts Social Security and Medicare on the table, they fall over themselves applauding for the move. They think that's mm-hmm. that's brilliant. There's it's very easy to see who the Democrats care about, and that's this sort of enlightened banker class, okay? Bankers who are liberals on social issues. That's who they care about. Who they don't care about is labor unions. The thing that would really
well, wait a minute. Obama went to Wisconsin what 14 times to stand with the
to back up the yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Or was it 15? I can't remember.
You know, and that's one of those stories that just breaks my heart. I'm from the Midwest. Wisconsin was always the sort of that was the state that you wanted to be like, that the other Midwestern states, you know, looked to as for sort of leadership. Wisconsin and Minnesota, and those are, I mean, very union-heavy states where being in a union and collective bargaining was part of the culture up there. That's, by the way, farmers also, mm-hmm. you know, with their co-ops, that's collective bargaining. Collective bargaining was the Midwestern way back in the day, and it's, you know, it's all being beaten down now. And the thing that could really change Obama or change the Democrats is if the labor movement walked away. But they can't anymore. These are some guys where these are the guys who are being most screwed by the sort of transformation of the Democrats into this party of enlightened banks. You know,
I heard Rich Trumka speak to a group of nurses in Washington in June, and he departed from his prepared text to say, and let me try to reconstruct the quote. He was talking about how Democrats take for granted that labor unions will always be yeah. there with cash and people. And he looked up at the nurses assembled and said, I don't know about you, but I've had a snootful of that shit. I don't think those words were in his
That's classic.
In his
That's
text.
Classic. No, and I like Rich Trumka, and he's the man is very blunt and forthright in his language, and I appreciate that. But there are precious few labor leaders with a lot of imagination and a lot of nerve anymore. I mean, that's something that has really disappeared in our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. And they're afraid to go it alone. I mean, they're getting beaten on all sides. I mean, you remember that? What's that famous line in Hemingway? He lost his fortune gradually, then all at once. That's what's happening to those guys. They've been beaten down gradually for decades, and now all of a sudden, you know, they're being destroyed, and they're scared. You know, they don't know what to do. So it seems unlikely that they would mount a challenge. But then again, you know, I always bring it back to the '30s. That was a we forget that before the big organizing drive of the mid-19, you know, 36, 37, that labor unions were on their back in the 30s. Their membership had declined dramatically. People wanted to be in labor unions, but there was no interest in organizing people and getting, you know, bringing people together. And it took all kinds of changes. And then what do you know, in just a matter of months, they were suddenly this huge player in national affairs. And, you know, it'd be nice to see that happen again, but I'm not holding my breath, as they say.
Now, this is mostly symbolism, but they have cited the renominating convention for Barack Obama in a right-to-work state where there are no hotels that have union employees. Now,
really? What is this, North Carolina?
Yeah. And it would be a brilliant stroke right now to say, you know what? We're moving the convention to Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, one of the states where the right wing, coordinated by ALEC, and we're going to talk about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, in our second segment with Mike Elk. But he should be there confronting the enemy and those who seek to dismantle the working class and the rights of union employees, particularly those who work for public entities. And instead, I believe that the concept is he's running for president as head of the centrist party, which, of course, does not exist either in form or in any reality. I mean, George Lakoff has, I think, very well described that this notion that there is a permanent center in American politics is bullshit, and that there is a center on any given issue.
This is one of my favorite subjects.
Well, talk about it. Go ahead.
I've been writing about this for a long time. This is the cult of centrism is what I used to call it. And that is the spirit of Washington, D.C., by the way. That is, people always say Washington, D.C. is this very liberal town, and it's not. It's a centrist town. All the sort of official organs of D.C. culture are about centrism. Centrism is the sort of wise, that's the course of wisdom. That's Brookings Institution, Washington Post, NPR. The political science discipline, the academic discipline that interact with politicians all the time is about centrism. They have figured that they understand politics as a sort of glorified form of economics where you have two firms competing for the man in the middle. And so they're driven automatically by forces of economics to the center. And the theory is so strong in political science that they blink out evidence to the contrary. And so they believe that this is the case and that this must be the case and that this is always the case. And of course, the Republican Party, as we know, behaves in a very different manner. And it can be easily documented, all the ways in which they aren't, moving to the center, competing for that voter in the center. I have a long, long, long explanation about the terminal irrelevance of centrism in my book that's coming out in 6 months or so. And I suggest all your listeners buy them. Hey, you want to know the title?
Yeah, that would help. Go ahead.
Pity the Billionaire.
Pity the Billionaire. Okay.
Pity the Billionaire, Peter B. Collins.
And can we advance order this at Amazon and put money in your pocket?
Not yet. Oh, okay. Not yet. You can, I don't know when they'll get something up over there, but, one of the themes in the book is how completely irrelevant that centrist narrative has become. This is an idea I've been working on for many years, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Cool. But, I can't wait to read that.
That's something. When I first moved to D.C., I moved to D.C. in 2003. What's the Matter with Kansas came out in 2004. And then in 2005, the Washington Post did a profile of me. And it was great. It was very flattering, that everybody wants to have the Washington Post do a profile of them. And they couldn't just do a profile of me. They had to ask people from the sort of the consensus community in D.C. what they thought of me. And so I forget who said it, and I'm probably going to mangle the quote also, but they said that nobody should listen to me because Tom Frank is outside the consensus. I always loved that line, outside the consensus.
You will never be conventionally wise.
That's right. I'm outside the consensus forever.
All right, I've got a tough one for you. We had a summer barbecue up the street the other night, and everybody there had supported and voted for Obama in 2008. and we were talking about our disappointments, and somebody provoked me with a tough question, and it was my neighbor Bill. He said, Peter, at this point, would you feel you should have voted for Hillary? And it's a really tough question because I'm put off by Hillary's hawkishness and her strong identity with the state of Israel. And I also didn't want to see a repeat of the Clinton dynasty and just alternate Clinton Bush for the foreseeable future. And I thought, oh, here comes somebody different from outside of Washington, not part
that's
of the.
Funny. That's what I thought too.
Yeah, not part of the old game. And
no, I was like, I am. I'll be damned if I'm voting for another Clinton.
Right.
You know.
And so I figured at minimum,
I don't want those people back. And sure enough, we got them back anyways.
He had the clearest position against the war in Iraq at any rate. He appeared to be somebody who would bring some new blood into Washington, but he didn't. And so When I look back at this, the one thing I know Hillary wouldn't have done was spent more than about 20 minutes trying to get Republican votes for a stimulus package in early 2009. And I don't think she would have courted Republicans begging them for votes on health care reform, even though I don't think what she would have embraced would have been that much different than Obama. Tactically, she would not have been pleading for Republicans to please, please like me.
You know, that may well be, but that's what her husband did. Come on. So,
well,
her husband did those things.
But don't you think after we've seen this pattern of Obama still expecting compromise from Republicans who, you know,
He's doing exactly what Bill Clinton did before. I mean, there's no way of knowing if it would have been different with another person. We took people like me. You know, you take your chance with what you know at the time.
Right.
Of course, it could have worked out differently, but you know, you do your best with the information that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
let's turn to your recent column.
Hell, maybe if John Edwards hadn't turned out to be such a terrible man, you know.
Well, he got that Tiger Woods problem. Your most recent column I really enjoyed because you reminded us of the recent past and the deregulation that was epitomized by Enron that is really still the meme and the mantra of the day. And that you went to press before S&P downgraded America's credit rating. But it's part and parcel of this same piece that the Arthur Andersons and the other people who were playing both sides, structuring deals and then participating in them, and knowing that there were toxic deals, toxic assets, or as Carl Levin would say, shitty deals that they got insured and promoted and sold out there and then took positions against. They hedged against them. So talk a little bit about this recent history, because, of course, most of the corporate media in our country only goes back about 22 seconds from the story they're reporting today.
Well, it's hard to believe, but it's and you probably won't hear much about this because we're the big anniversary that's coming up, of course, is the anniversary of September the 11th. But I was thinking about that summer 10 years ago, and the other 10 year anniversary that we're coming up on is the 10th anniversary of the collapse of Enron. And it took place gradually then all at once over the course of that summer and
that's
the fall
right.
of 2011 or 2001. And I was at the time I was fascinated by Enron. I had been doing research on them before. I had written a book called One Market Under God, and they had been in it, or I had done a lot of research on them for the book. I don't remember if I included it or not, but I had written about them a number of times in magazines and a newspaper in Chicago that I wrote for at the time. I was fascinated by these guys because they weren't, they were technically an oil and gas pipeline company, but what they really seemed to deal in was ideology. I don't know if you remember this, but they would run these TV commercials, not just in their home market in Houston, but all over America, talking about the wonders of deregulation and talking about markets in this kind of religious way. This is in the late 90s and the early aughts, and they did a lot of this. And anyhow, so I looked back at the Enron scandal. I went and got out my old articles on the company, and I got out some of the old books that came out. out about them and read back over it. And it's amazing how many of the incidents that have happened since that time, 10 years ago, the Enron scandal, you know, it gave you this foretaste of everything that happened, you know, this. And so it occurred to me that the last 10 years and I think going into the future is basically the age of Enron. OK, and let me go through some of the things that their worship of markets, for one thing. And even Enron, you know, Enron went down. They couldn't put a dent in that. But then the thing that you mentioned, which is really fascinating to me, about conflicts of interest. The Enron scandal was about conflicts of interest. I mean, the company insiders setting up these special purpose vehicles run by other company insiders just to do business with the company. And then these were signed off on by their auditor, Arthur Anderson. And then this all blows up, of course. Everybody goes down. Everybody gets burned. Everybody gets ruined. Arthur Anderson even goes out of business. And then you see the same thing happening in the, you know, in the mortgage industry, all sorts of other places across the economy, these conflicts of interest, you know, just erupting. And the one that you mentioned is probably the most classic is the bond rating agencies, who are now downgrading America's debt, and where they get the nerve to do something like that. I mean, these were the guys that were just totally in bed with the Wall Street companies whose toxic products they were labeling AAA. Mm-hmm. I mean, they should, by all rights, be out of business themselves, you know. And deregulation, okay? Here's another one. Enron was made possible by deregulation. The company existed because of the deregulation of natural gas. There were special deregulatory laws written just for them. Phil Gramm of Texas, a senator from Texas, wrote the famous Enron loophole that allowed their energy trading derivatives, this kind of thing.
While his wife Wendy served on the board of Enron.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's amazing that you know that.
Oh, yeah.
But the story goes on and on.
I even know about Dickie Flat, okay?
Yeah. Dickie Flat's in my book. Did you ever see he wrote – I made fun of Phil Gramm in the Wall Street Journal once. Dickie Flat actually wrote a letter to the editor.
There is a Dickie?
The guy is real, yeah. The actual guy.
I think he was Phil's printer, right? He printed the campaign posters and bumper stickers.
He was a printer, yes.
He was his
right.
Just Folks guy. Whenever Phil Gramm wanted to go Just Folks on you, well, Dickie Flat says.
That's right. That's exactly right. But here's a really interesting fact that I found out. You know how the financial crisis was made possible by deregulation, but not just by de jure deregulation, where the law is overturned, but by de facto deregulation, where you stop enforcing, where you put somebody that doesn't believe in the law in charge, you know, the sort of what they call de-supervision. And
the wrecking crew.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I found this amazing little bit of little anecdote in the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission's report, where it's not in their report, it's on their website, where there's a guy who is the chief regulator for the Federal Reserve. Okay. And the Federal Reserve totally dropped the ball. They were charged with overseeing the various mortgage lenders. And they're just like, no, we don't feel like doing it. We don't feel like regulating them. So they just let it go, you know. But here's the guy who was the chief bank regulator at the Fed. And he said that he and his colleagues had pushed for new rules over on derivatives in the late 1990s. But the Fed, you know, the bosses at the Fed said no. And their rationale for saying no was that, well, look at Enron. Enron doesn't need rules, you know, because the market can enforce things with this mystical hand of discipline and all this kind of bullshit. Mm-hmm. And I'm allowed to say that on Peter B. Collins.
Yes,
right?
You may. You will not be bleeped.
Yes, and so I love that Enron was the justification for the deregulatory act that then gave us the financial crisis.
And allow me to quote from your column in the August edition of Harper's. Since then, we have learned how Washington Mutual schemed to sell option adjustable rate mortgages, our most profitable mortgage loan, in quotes, even though option arms actually sucked for most borrowers. We found out that Angelo Mozzillo, CEO of subprime lender Countrywide, described one of his company's own offerings thusly, quote, "In all my years in the business, I have never seen a more toxic product. We discovered that Goldman Sachs executives viewed a particular collateralized debt obligation as one shitty deal, but sold it anyway. Ever since Enron, pugnacious trader talk of this sort has been a constant background noise to American life. But like a kidnapped victim with Stockholm Syndrome, we love the lout in spite of it all. Though he slays our bank account, yet we will trust in him, aspiring to his lifestyle, emulating his swaggering ways. And that is so true. I mean, the business pages celebrate people who are ridiculously wealthy and who have fleeced the shareholders of a company using options that don't get reported or accounted for, that essentially is stealing from the rest of the shareholders. But that's we exactly sit back right. and say, oh, wow, he got a new Maserati. How cool.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah. And you just turn on the radio station that plays the top 40 music. And it's every other song is about how awesome that lifestyle is. This is what we're all about. We never get over our love for the lout. And where this begins with Enron is these amazing, you know, the California energy crisis in 2001.
I do
which
know.
Is essentially, you remember that, right?
Yes, I do.
It was man-made. It was made. It wasn't. They were always saying, "Oh, well, we didn't build enough power plants." Rubbish. They had plenty of power. It was the energy. They had deregulated the market, and the energy traders at Enron and a couple of other firms were able to game the system. It was incredibly easy. But what was funny was a couple years later, these tapes were revealed of these traders chatting amongst themselves as they ripped off people in California, and they said these incredibly vile things. Do you remember this?
Oh, I do.
The guy who just steals money out of California. Here's one of my favorite. A guy was saying that it was a great system because it weeds the weak people out of the market, you know, referring to to users of electricity. Get rid of them, and you know what? The people who are strong will stick around. Okay, and some of these guys actually went to jail, you know, in the aftermath of this. Of this fiasco, but we as a nation cannot get over our love for this crap. You read Ayn Rand when you were younger.
Yes,
Ayn Rand adores people like this. These kind of loutish, bloodthirsty, predatory traders. In fact, in Galt's famous speech in Atlas Shrugged, it's about the trader is the highest order of mankind. You know, and in the aftermath of a crisis brought on by exactly these people. That is the novel that we have decided is like the greatest work of fiction in American history.
Well, a couple
it's
of things.
The age of Enron.
A couple
of
things.
It's never going to end.
A couple of things on Enron in California. First of all, I'm still bitter because once the lights started to go out here, I decided my utility bills are going up, so I need to hedge. So I bought 100 shares of Enron.
Oh, no.
And I bought it for 60 and I sold it for $6. So that's how I got burned by Kenny Boy and his goons. But I just wanted to add a pretext here, because the reason that Enron was able to game and El Paso Natural Gas was a player as well. The reason they were able to game the system in California was that Pacific Gas and Electric, based in San Francisco, and they serve about 40% of the state, they had written the bill and jammed it through the legislature with zero debate and I think even no negative votes, that deregulated the industry and allowed them to sell off their power plants. They were going to go virtual and just wheel in power from wherever they needed.
Awesome.
But they failed. The biggest thing they failed to do was to enhance the distribution system from south to north. And what happened in 2002 was that we were unable to buy power from WHOOPS, from Washington State, because their hydros were underperforming due to a drought. And so the traditional pipelines to wheel electricity into California were ineffective. There just wasn't enough inventory. And the demand was to move power from the southern part of the state to the north, and it was called Path 15, and it runs through the Central Valley. And PG&E had never upgraded that to permit for, heavy usage in the event of the shortages from other places. So this made us extremely vulnerable, and the Enron boys just moved in for the kill.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny. So there's a lot of good detail there. And one of the details that I remember being struck by was that Los Angeles, do you remember, owned its own power generating right. system and never had any problems. But according to the logic of the age of Enron, the answer to that
was to
is for the state government to step in. Yes, exactly. To somehow privatize it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to replicate that success story, you know, the one place in the state that didn't have this catastrophe, but to ruin it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they've got around to that yet, but I'm sure they will. Another thing that got me about the age of Enron was how beloved that company was before it went down, before the scandal. The management theorists adored Enron. I mean, some of them were badly embarrassed by it after the collapse. But I remember walking through an airport right when I was writing about Enron, and I was sort of starting to – I never figured out the scandals that brought them down or anything like that. But they were plenty bad. You know, that was easy to figure out. But I remember seeing on the cover of a business magazine a picture of Jeff Skilling with his finger over his lips going, shh, you know. But he was supposed to be – you know, there he was on the cover. He was supposed to be so awesome. And that was right before the collapse. I mean, that was on mm-hmm. newsstands right as they were going down, so a decade ago. But they were beloved. And then you look at all the other companies that have been that have done these terrible things to us. Every single one of them has been – you know, a beloved company. Goldman Sachs, you know, world's most admired companies, according to Fortune magazine. Washington Mutual was always supposed to be innovative.
Right.
The Alexander the Great of the thrift industry. I love that one. Angelo Mozillo of Countrywide. Have you ever seen this? What he said about his own company that made more difference to society, to the integrity of our society than any company in the history of America. Countrywide.
Yeah.
And it you know, and then of course the relationship of these companies with the politicians. Enron was very, very close to both President Bush and President Bush's dad, you know, the two presidents Bush.
Well, the other key to their belovedness, Tom, was that they spread a lot of party cash around, both to political campaigns and for example, they were not even selling power in California at the time, but they bought the rights to the new baseball stadium in San Francisco. And they just put up signage there to promote themselves, but they didn't have an active business in California at the time. So they were very
that's
conscious.
Right.
Of,
that's, and they were doing that in Illinois. That's how I first found out about them, is they were running advertisements in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And I lived in Chicago at the time. And they had no business in Illinois. They didn't own any power plants. They didn't do anything there. And that's why I got so intrigued by it. It was it was so peculiar.
Now let's
last thing I say.
Go ahead.
Last feature of the age of Enron, and I'll just do this in one sentence. We will not get it. We will do exactly the opposite of what needs to happen. Right?
Yeah.
We'll go out and buy thousands of copies of Atlas Shrugged. You know, we'll privatize and deregulate even more. We will not get it. This is the age of Enron. We do everything in reverse.
Well, Tom, I'd like to come back to a point you made a moment ago and close on this about privatization, because we're seeing an incredible orchestrated and coordinated effort to privatize prisons, to privatize all kinds of functions of government. And this is being driven by this murky group, ALEC, that we're going to talk about in the next segment, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They write boilerplate legislation to deny union representation to state workers. They write the voter ID laws. And all of these are part of a comprehensive effort to shrink government and to privatize, corporatize as much as possible of what government has been doing. And I see this as a very dangerous trend. And because we're all broke, I mean, Jerry Brown has stopped the Schwarzenegger plan to sell public buildings and bridges to private interests in the state. But it'll probably come back because the economy is so bad and we're desperate for cash.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. And you know what? Look, this is something that's been – I remember encountering ALEC when I wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, because they obviously had a big hand in the conservative revolution in that state. And what you say is true. So they write this boilerplate legislation, and it gets picked up and adopted in different variations all over the country. It's always amazing to me the kind of money that is behind the conservative movement, that they're able to you know, figure something out like that and put it into effect. And also amazing that, you know, the effort to privatize these things. I wrote about this in the journal, back when I wrote for the Wall Street Journal, it would be 2 or 3 years ago, about privatizing highways. There was this big push. And in Chicago, they privatized parking meters. Did you hear about this?
No.
It's just, it was, it's completely backfired. It's like turned out to be the worst public policy move ever. But they did it. And they can't get out of it. You know, they signed this deal for 99 years or whatever it is. And they've privatized the Chicago Skyway, which is a big highway there.
They Indiana,
They've privatized – yeah, that's right. They've privatized all sorts of different highways around the country. And it's usually winds up being a terrible, terrible deal for the taxpayers. And people are – you know, states and cities and governments are forced into it because they're so short of money. They don't know what else to do. You know, the last time this happened, you know, in the 1930s, they just went – you know, they just stopped delivering services. But then eventually the federal government stepped in and rescued the states and the city governments. Well, that's not going to happen this time because we don't have Franklin Roosevelt in the White House. You know, we have basically we've got Herbert Hoover in there, you know, Herbert Hoover, who's a liberal on social issues.
Yeah.
But otherwise that's what's going on. But what's funny is that the financial community has advanced so far that they're able to come up with this, you know, private sector solution and offer it to states. And a lot of the states are there so desperate, they'll go for it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a tragic and a stupid thing to do. And the problem is that it's very hard for journalists to look into. I know because I tried myself to dig into the privatization of roads and bridges and things like that, and it's extremely complicated. Almost nobody understands it except for the people that designed the deal, and so it turns out to be very difficult for journalists to write about, and we wind up just accepting it. You know, hey, it's free money, right?
Okay, my real last topic here is the 12-member super committee that is going to wrestle with the deficit, and should they fail, these triggers kick in with across-the-board cuts. And it seems to me that this is another way of empowering Grover frickin' Norquist. he is responsible for the mess here in California. Jerry Brown couldn't even get two members of each house from the Republican Party to vote just to extend the tax increases that Arnold Schwarzenegger put into effect 2 years ago. And then they wouldn't even allow him to put it on the ballot so that the people could decide, even if Grover Norquist objected. So now this 12-member panel, six Republicans who are all pledgees to Grover Norquist's No New Taxes Compact, this is a recipe for disaster. I mean, we can see it right here. Javier Becerra, the congressman from Los Angeles, is the only nominal liberal and embracer of the New Deal who is on the entire commission. And so it just strikes me that they're going to put together the most onerous package and force an up or down vote to avoid the triggers.
I think that's probably right. I honestly don't know what's going to happen there. And I wonder about that Grover Norquist thing myself, because it's not really, you know, Grover's fault. He's done this thing, and it's a sort of grandiose PR gesture. It's these congressmen's fault for thinking that they're bound by that rather than by, you know, doing what's best for their constituents and what's best for the country. And it seems incredible. It seems unbelievable that someone could fear Grover Norquist so much that Grover does not have the kind of clout of these other players that we're talking about. You know, he's a lone lobbyist with, you know, he's a very intelligent guy, but he doesn't have the kind of clout that we're talking about here. That these people are afraid of him is amazing to me.
Well, he does have enforcement capabilities of his mafia style approach here in California. Because when Republicans have voted for tax increases, he funds a recall or challenges them with another Republican at the next election. And so,
no, that's right. They do that.
They've broken enough
but
knees.
But that's like Club for Growth and that sort of thing.
Well, Pat Toomey is Mr. Club for Growth. He's on the 12-member panel.
That's right. That's what I'm. Yeah. Yeah, those guys are scary, and that's just the muscle of big money. That's all it is. It's amazing what money can do in this country.
Yeah.
There's the wisdom for our times. That's the age of Enron for
age
you.
Age of Enron. Tom Frank, always great to talk to you. Thanks for indulging me today.
Anytime, Peter B. Collins.
And we'll look for your new book, Pity the Billionaire, sometime very soon, toward the end of the year, early next year.
Yeah, you're going to like it. It's good.
Okay. 10-4. Thanks for talking with me.
All right. We'll see ya.
Earlier this year, Arianna Huffington sold the Huffington Post to AOL for $300+ million. Did she share it with the writers?
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within.
Ah, but she's got that sweet accent. Mike Elk is a journalist, a labor activist, and he's been writing about the strike that was called by bloggers and those who have contributed for years without pay to the Huffington Post. Mike, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Peter, it's great to be on the show.
And I wish I could pay you for your appearance today, but I don't have $300 million of AOL's money.
I don't have it either.
Now, how long did you write for the HuffPo?
So I wrote there under an agreement where I was writing there as part of a job that I had at a think tank, a labor-funded think tank.
A stink tank?
Yeah, a labor-funded think tank.
I
tried to put up a stink, but was never quite too good at it. but we tried to use the Huffington Post to make a stink about things, and so I wrote there for about 16 months. I wrote 105 articles, all of them unpaid. And some of them I contributed actually original reporting, and some of them I did on my own occasionally. When I couldn't find an outlet as a freelancer to do, I would do it for free.
And what kind of benefits did you get from it? Because Huffington and her allies say that people who have submitted and been published at the Huffington Post benefit from the wide distribution, along with all the gossip and Hollywood-type stuff that draws lots of flies to the Huffington Post website.
Yeah, I don't think I got much benefit out of it.
A T-shirt, a tote bag made in China?
No, nothing quite like that. I got fired and publicly humiliated for participating in a protest. That's all I really got out of it.
Yeah. And but you know, they really lean heavily on this idea that there are huge intangible benefits to ego and visibility and the ability to reach large numbers of people. And Huffington Post does have a lot of traffic. Earlier this year, they surpassed the New York Times in average weekly web traffic. So I do give Arianna and the people who work there credit for building a pretty impressive distribution system. But it does trouble me that when she scored the big payday, that she didn't just peel off $1 million and say, look, people have been working hard for the Huffington Post for many years, and I want to share this windfall with them. And it would have been a gracious gesture that would have earned a lot of goodwill. And even if you, Mike Elk, had only gotten $25 out of it, it would have been some recognition of the contributions that you made to the profits that she just scored.
Yeah, or they could have even sent me a tote bag.
Made in China.
Made in China, most likely.
So now we have a kind of unofficial labor action because the writers for the Huffington...
It's an official labor action.
Well, I guess maybe ad hoc or virtual is the right way because, you know, there's not a formal union. You can't gather in one place and march on a picket line. So it is a strike that has been called by the contributors. How many people have been withholding content from Huffington Post?
Hundreds have, according to the union.
Uh-huh.
And it's called both a boycott and a picket line, you know, in the sense that you boycott a business that has unfair labor practices. And in this case, we're boycotting by not giving them our traffic in the way that, because essentially traffic is ad revenue.
That's
so
true.
It's not just a boycott of contributors to Huffington Post, but also it's a boycott of people linking to the Huffington Post, putting it on their Facebook, putting it on their Twitter.
And what kind of impact have you been able to see?
I mean, Arianna Huffington is worried about it. I mean, that much is clear, is that she can't dodge the issue, that this has remained an issue for months now after the sale of AOL. So I think we see an impact in that way. But I think it gets to something more deeper than that, which is, you brought up, part of the reason people blog for the Huffington Post is because of what it does for their ego, right? I would go one step further and say, what we've been able to do with this boycott is say to writers, look, you do not have to write for free. I mean, you know as well as I do, I get propositions from small publications where they say, hey, come write for us for free. You know, I've had stuff reprinted without my consent in publications, and they won't pay me. And we see this happening all the time in creative industries. So I think what this boycott is really about is saying, look, you do not need to be treated this way.
And, for example, some of the people who haven't been honoring the boycott and the virtual picket line include Jan Schakowsky's husband. His name is Bob Cremer, or Cramer, I think he pronounces it. And he's a Chicago political operator. He works as a consultant and works on campaigns, and he writes about political strategy. And he said, well, I'm not a professional writer. I do this on the side because I'm trying to generate political activism and momentum around progressive causes that he supports. How do you view that? Do you think he should be honoring the picket line, and do you think he's weaseling out by claiming, well, I'm just not a journalist?
He's weaseling out. So essentially, this is both a boycott and a picket line. If, you know, the United Farm Workers said, hey, we're not going to buy grapes anymore from these people who exploit it, does somebody say, I don't respect that picket line because I'm not a grape grower, I eat grapes, I'm not a grape... I mean, this is completely illogical. The fact is, every major union leader in this country is refusing to blog for the Huffington Post or link to the Huffington Post. Every major union leader. So for somebody that receives a mass amount of money from organized labor, it is simply unacceptable that they continue writing that and continue, quite frankly, taking food off of my table.
So where will this lead, in your view, Mike Elk?
Well, I think, one, if you look at the credibility of the Huffington Post, I think they're never going to be taken seriously as a news organization as long as they have this brand along their neck. Who wants to take seriously a news organization that doesn't pay its writers? And I think of all the news organizations out there, I think the Huffington Post respectability is pretty low.
And what about the AOL local news service called Patch? Do you have an opinion about that? And should writers be withholding from that as a way of joining the HuffPo boycott and picket line?
Yeah, I think writers that aren't getting paid by them should be withholding.
Well, they do pay. Patch does pay. They don't pay big, but they do pay writers.
But increasingly, you know, if you see what Tim Armstrong does, is that he wants Patch to look more like the Huffington Post, where writers aren't getting paid.
And beyond this, there are other issues. For example, I work pretty closely with Jason Leopold at truthout.org.
I know Jason.
And Jason does incredible investigative reports, and his most recent story, for example, caused the Air Force to change its policies regarding training people using religious themes. And it was picked up by CNN, by Fox, and by others, and no credit is given for the work that's done. They just act like they discovered these stories or originated them on their own. What kind of do you think that we can appeal just to people's ethics and sense of propriety, or do you think we need regulations to protect the work of independent journalists and nonprofit journalists in this new media world?
I mean, there already are a great deal of regulations, for instance, on the issue of unpaid labor. I would argue that I think Arianna Huffington is breaking the law. She's a for-profit company. For-profit companies can only have people working for them in very clear situations. And the relationship that Arianna Huffington has towards her contributors is not like on Facebook or Twitter. On Facebook or Twitter, you can put up anything you want. On Huffington Post, there are very clear guidelines of what you can and cannot write. You cannot use anonymous sourcing. they will call you and they will ask about fact-checking. There's a number of things you can't do, and if you cross those lines, they'll dismiss you. I was dismissed, for instance, for helping 200 construction workers break into a conference of bankers. They felt that that could impinge on their brand as a journalistic brand. So their relationship is employee-like, and it needs to be regulated like any other employee-like relationship.
Mm-hmm.
If Arianna Huffington, I was talking to a construction worker, if Arianna Huffington is allowed to get away with this, pretty soon we're going to be seeing young kids walking around construction sites working for free. Imagine if General Motors said to unpaid desperate writers, to unpaid workers, unemployed workers, hey, why don't you come down to the assembly line and you can volunteer whenever you want, gain some exposure, gain some reputational currency, as they like to call it, as mm-hmm. opposed to real currency that can buy food.
Yeah,
we would all be upset about that. Because in this economy, especially in journalism, we've lost 30,000 journalists to layoffs in the last 5 years. In that kind of situation where we've lost a third of the industry, and people are desperate, people love this craft, and people feel a commitment to the things that they cover, you're going to see a mass amount of people working for free. And to get back to the issue you do about artistic license, the real shame of the Huffington Post is they have over 5,000 bloggers. Most of them do what I do, which is they work at a nonprofit, or they work at a union, or they work at some type of organization, a large degree.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what these nonprofits and these unions are doing is they're using their money to subsidize a press that's owned by Arianna Huffington. They're providing free content, as opposed to using that money they're using on staffers that are developing op-eds and developing sometimes very detailed research reports that they're putting up on the Huffington Post, as opposed to developing their own alternative media,
mm-hmm.
their own structure that isn't based on this kind of profit-driven. Arianna Huffington has all the control, and if you don't like the way, you can be fired.
And Mike, you made the point that 30,000 journalists have been laid off in the last few years, and if we just do a rough calculation of the work that is missing, the reports that were not done, the stories that were not written or filed, there's a huge hole in the national conversation, and it allows concocted news, controlled news, news product, and Hollywood-based gossip news to dominate because it's cheaper for them to act as stenographers and just grab it and publish it.
Yeah, it's cheaper for them to do that. And also, imagine a world. So, AOL CEO Tim Armstrong was quoted in Forbes magazine saying the key to growing profitability is to recruit more horde of free, unpaid bloggers. Imagine a world in which the people doing investigative journalism are people doing it, after their job or in their spare time. That's not how you do investigative journalism. I can tell you that as an investigative journalist. It's very tough work. It requires a lot of financing. But when you do it, you can have big impacts.
Mm-hmm.
And we do not want to get into a state, I think, as a democracy where we look to the Huffington Post as a model of investigative journalism. I mean, granted, their staffers have done great work, but we just don't want to get into that model.
Yeah. Mike, finally on the HuffPo issue, what does it all tell you about Arianna Huffington? I first met her in the early 90s when she was married to the man whose name she still bears, Michael Huffington. He ran one of the dirtiest campaigns up to that point, self-finance campaigns up to that point in California as he tried to defeat Senator Feinstein. And she revealed herself at that time to be a political opportunist. And then, she got in bed with Al Franken, figuratively. It was on TV, and I don't think they were doing anything that would be tweeted by Anthony Weiner. But, from there, she reinvented herself as an anti-Bush progressive voice. And this episode with her sale to AOL and the way she feels entitled to exploit the work of people like you is quite revealing. And so it just raises the question, who is Arianna Huffington and which is the real Arianna?
Well, I don't know who the real Arianna Huffington is. Because while people can argue she was a Republican who crossed sides, her parents were also members, Greek communists. And, she was brought up in a very left-wing household in Greece, so I don't think her parents would be very proud of what she's doing. I don't think they would support the ideas. I mean, her father was a Greek resistance fighter, you know, who ran a Greek newspaper. So I don't think her father would be very happy with what she's doing. But this gets to a bigger issue, which is that Arianna Huffington, whether you say she's truly Republican or truly a Democrat, is an elite. She's not somebody who really sees power in groups. She sees power in being a charismatic spokesperson. And what I found so depressing being here in Washington is how many organizations used to invite her, progressive organizations, to their conferences to speak.
Yeah.
As if this was the only leader they had, this turncoat Republican who had all this money and would say kind of outlandish things and, you know, had a website with a lot of traffic. I mean, it was just astounding to me, the number mm-hmm. of people that invited her.
Yeah, I agree. It was very interesting. Yeah. I remember she came to the Green Festival here in San Francisco a few years back, and I interviewed her there. And I just thought it was a little bit unusual because she is an elite, a social climber, very comfortable in very wealthy circles. And here she was with the hemp crowd, and I thought it was a real culture clash.
Well, let's get to something else that I want to get to, which is the number of people on the left, especially that are defending the Huffington Post, the number of reporters here in D.C., which is that they have established this edgy brand. It's like, you know, we're going to take on the New York Times brand. And do we really want to take on the New York Times? I mean, do we really want that? I mean, I don't know. I tend to think of the New York Times as great reporting, and I think Huffington Post is just somebody that likes to hold up their finger to the wind. And, you know, there's some good reporters over there, but for the most part, it's insane to watch the people that are defending them.
And you want to name names? Who is defending them?
Well, I think the worst defender of this is Arthur Delaney,
mm-hmm.
who is the Huffington Post reporter assigned to cover largely unemployment, who makes fun of the writer's strike regularly and uses arguments by the Cato Institute, the union-busting Cato Institute, to do it. Now, I mean, is he a frat boy or a reporter? I mean, does he not make sense to him why there are so many journalists unemployed while his publication is using unpaid labor?
Very good point. Now, Mike, I know you're busy and I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I would like to direct people to a powerful story that you co-authored that is still available at thenation.com about this murky group called the American Legislative Exchange Committee, or what I'm not sure what the C stands for, Council.
Yeah.
And this is the group that is funded by the Koch brothers and other oligarchs, and it has been writing the boilerplate union-busting legislation, the boilerplate voter ID, which is voter suppression legislation, and they just had a conference in New Orleans where many elected officials came to pay homage. And you have written a powerful story. You broke a story that shows a long history of ALEC paving the way for the exploitation of prison labor in this country. Tell us a little bit about that.
Basically, ALEC, by far one of the most, it's this organization. What happens is in state legislatures, they don't have a lot of staff. They often are part-time legislators. So they rely on outside groups to help them write very technical, detailed legislation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And with ALEC, by far the most perverse effect they've had is that the massive increase in prison population. So ALEC is an organization that, you know, has corporate sponsors. One of their sponsors, two of them, are GEO Group and Corrections Corporation of America, private prison companies. So in 1980, you had only 500,000 prisoners in jail in the U.S. Now you have 2.4 million in jail.
Right.
The United States has 4% of the world's population, yet we have 25% of the world's prisoners. And this is due to the fact that ALEC works successfully to pass laws to, you know, put drug offenders, people that just, you know, bought drugs, away for a very long time. Now, what's interesting is ALEC only started passing these laws after, in the 1980s, they were able to start passing laws at the state level, privatizing prisons, allowing private prisons to make profit off of having people in jail. We have this situation where they build up this massive prison population, and now they've passed legislation at the state level that allows private prisoners to work for 20 cents an hour making products that directly compete with union workers in the private workplace.
Mm-hmm. And that's a labor pool that's even cheaper than the labor pools we exploit in Mexico, China, and other parts of the world.
Yeah, in fact, you go to some of these conferences where they talk about it, and there's, you know, they'll stand up and they'll say, you know, a lot of companies will say, it's too expensive for us to go to China now. We got to go somewhere else. Because, you know, the workers' wages are starting to raise a little bit there, so they got to find somewhere else. And where do they go? They go to the one place cheaper, American prison labor.
And, Mike, there's no regulation that requires goods or products made in prison to be labeled as prison manufactured, is there?
No, in fact, they're labeled made in America. So many well-intentioned people are trying to buy these products, and they might actually be supporting prison labor.
And give us a couple of examples. One is that school cafeterias include food that was made in prisons?
Yeah, and often with very little oversight. For example, in 2005, ATO Industry was cited for giving out, you know, 1.4 million pounds of meat that was infected with rat feces, right? And they, you know, ATO wanted to do a voluntary recall, but they couldn't. USDA didn't want it. Department of Justice, a bunch of other forces, didn't want people, didn't want it getting out there how much meat was being used like this, right? So what happened instead was, They recalled it. And to be the interesting thing is that in 95, the U.S. government passed a law which allowed the oversight of prison industries in this country to be transferred from the Department of Justice to the nonprofit National Correctional Industries Association. Mm. This is sort of like transferring bank regulation from the SEC to the American Bankers Association. You can imagine what results. And so we see mass abuse of prisoners where prisoners are forced to work. I mean, you saw the Georgia prison riots where prisoners rioted at eight different prisons.
Mm-hmm. Mike, your story also details the way that, for example, the printing operations in the Florida prison system are directly competing with commercial printers, including union shops, and this is producing a kind of unfair competition.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, it's producing a, you know, just absolutely huge unfair competition. So, because of this competition. So, I mean, it's just, it's incredible. The I mean, some of the businesses have been driven out of business because they can't compete with the cost of prison labor.
Mm-hmm. And, Mike, one of the other concerns I have is that private prisons, corporate prisons, are currently concentrated in the in ICE, the Homeland Security's detention facilities for immigrants, and these are, you know, very dangerous places where the guards are often quite corrupt, where sexual favors of both male and female inmates are demanded for just humane treatment. And I've done several interviews with whistleblowers who worked as guards in these corporate-owned prisons. And it appears that there is no oversight and that they are beyond the reach of most law enforcement agencies and that the federal Justice Department has no interest in policing wrongdoing that occurs in private prisons.
No, I mean, the growth of prisons in this country is truly one of the most sick tales of how corporations are really owning the American political process for their own profit motives. I mean, look at the piece my colleague Bu Holliday did for In These Times last year, where he showed that ALEC had arranged meetings between the private prison industry groups and Arizona state legislators drafting the anti-immigration bill there, because it would have created more people detained.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I want to add here that in California, we have a somewhat anomalous situation where the prison guards union, and Mike, I'm a longtime labor guy myself, and I support collective bargaining, and I support public employees, and I deplore the way that Walker in Wisconsin and his clones in Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio have worked to deny public employees union representation. That said, the prison guards union here in California has gone way too far in impacting public policy. And they only support policies that produce a greater prison population because they know that the more prisoners there are, the more guards and guard hours will be required to manage the prisons. And the CCPOA, that's what it's called, the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, is in disarray now. They've had some internal problems, and they're fighting among one another. But in the past 20 years, they have showered millions of dollars that they collect from their members on political candidates and office holders in the state. And they were instrumental in passing the three strikes law that has expanded the prison population with petty criminals who are there for 15 years on a second strike, 25 to life on a third. And so how do we combat that force? Because that's a virus in the labor movement.
Yeah, I think it's a bad virus. I mean, there's too many labor leaders, I think, that are too short-sighted. We can have unionized employees. I mean, so if you look at, for example, what SEI Local 1000 is trying to do in California, which is they're trying to get money away from prisons and into social workers and places like that,
mm-hmm.
we can have all kind of different things that can create good union jobs and fund them. And I think it's very short-sighted, and it turns away our allies when we support bad policies that are bad for America.
Indeed. Well, I want to direct people. I'll link in the show file at peterbcollins.com to your piece about the Huffington Post and also to your story that you co-authored about Alec. And I really appreciate the work you do, Mike. Thank you for joining us today.
No problem.
Mike Elk here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for listening. And if you have a comment or a reaction, send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.